yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying.
Well, a big hearty welcome to you listening out there to a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. I'm Bob Frelick in the studio with...
I'm Julia Minton.
And
I missed you last month, Bob.
Well, yes, I missed you. I always miss you.
It's because, good to be back.
You know, I get carried away and sometimes don't know what the heck I'm talking about. And you keep me grounded here. So I really appreciate your presence. Well, I do want to welcome you to this show, and I'm going to tell you very shortly what the topic for this evening is. As I say, we're a show about critical thinking and related topics, and the more I delve into the whole issue of critical thinking, the more I see how many related topics there are. We have an almost infinite list of future shows. And by the way, you can contact us and tell us what you'd like to hear on this show. Give us feedback about the show. Tell them how to do that.
Yeah, we love hearing from you. And we're real people. I'm Julia. This is Bob. And you can contact us. You can find us on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio. Just put that into your little search bar on Facebook and like our page. Bob's very good at putting up promos for every show that's coming up. And it's a great way to communicate with us and other fans as well.
Yeah, it really helps us because it clears up our thinking to hear from you.
We've had so many good suggestions and a number of shows based on the suggestions of folks that contacted us. So I really do encourage you to give us your feedback.
So keep them coming. And you can go back and listen to some of our previous shows. If something we say in one show triggers something and refers to a previous show, we do have a podcast version of this show.
We do.
And it's at
thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.
That'll pop up on iTunes also.
Any podcasting app. The podcasting app I use, I just go to add feed. I search Thinking Clearly and boop, it comes right up. You can subscribe, which means all of our new shows will automatically come into your podcast app. And you can go back and listen to our entire archive history if you just can't get enough of us today.
And we've developed a long description of what critical thinking is. It's getting longer all the time because it has a lot of different elements into it. But I'm not going to go through the whole description. But the short version is that critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust, that's important, robust cross-section of evidence. So we're not just cherry-picking evidence that are going to confirm or disconfirm our belief, but we're actually doing a wide-ranging search of evidence on an issue. And a thorough examination and evaluation of that evidence relevant to the issue at hand that we're attempting to explore when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. So it's evidence-based beliefs and conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And a little clue about what the topic is tonight. It goes back, and we've done this on a number of different topics, have a part two. And so we are going to have a part two of what we explored last month. And last month, we had a great guest on. He's a repeat guest. He's been on the show before.
And I hope we have him back again.
Oh, yes. Love Kevin de LaPlante. Kevin de LaPlante. He's a philosopher, podcaster, critical thinking master teacher. And here's a quote. And this is from a sketchbook video that he did called The Dangers of Tribalism. And it goes like this, quote, "Now, there's an obvious dark side to polarization. It's not hard to see how increasing polarization in our tribal psychology can lead to serious social and political problems and a distorted perception of the world." He introduced the topic for us last month, and we're going to carry it on in a little different fashion. We're going to have some audio clips from several other folks that are weighing in on the topic. And I'm sure those clips are going to prompt a little back and forth between Julia and I on the topic. And we don't rehearse ahead of time what we're going to say. So it's a surprise to, both of us. Sometimes what I'm going to say is a surprise to me.
Yeah,
it's not what I'm going to say that's a surprise. It's what I do say that is the surprise. So at any rate, we're going to carry on and do a part two on that topic of tribalism.
And just in case you missed part one, you can catch it in the archive.
That's right. Just go back to thinkingclearly.lipson.com, and it'll pop up there. And you can download it or listen to it, whatever you want. It's completely free. So tribalism, why don't you go over a definition? It's great to define terms so that we all are, that's great critical thinking or in engaging anyone in discussion. It's a wonderful thing to start out by defining your terms so that you don't wind up discussing for an hour and a half and finding that you had different definitions of the terms.
That's happened to me a few times.
Quite a few to me. So why don't you tackle that definition? It's a short definition.
Sure, tribalism. Well, and this is really important because tribalism is one of those words that's used in many different ways. In this case, we're talking about the behavior and attitudes that stem from strong loyalty to one's own tribe or social group.
Yeah. And that's the way we're using it now, and we'll talk about that. That's quite a different definition than an anthropologist would define tribal.
Absolutely.
Or tribe. And we'll get into that as the show goes on, because that's one of the issues we want to talk about. The other key term is polarization, and in the context that we're using it, it's a measure of the magnitude of difference between groups in their claims, beliefs, attitudes, and values. That when extreme, in other words, when that magnitude is great, it may result in a lack of empathy, loss of common ground, and lead to segregation and non-recognition of one group by the other in the very extreme. So we're talking about tribalism and polarization tonight. And so let's start out to lay the foundation with a clip. And this is from an interview that was on NPR's Fresh Air back in December 6th of last year. The interview was done by Terry Gross, and it's with a person whose name is Jeff Nunberg, and he's the linguist contributor for that show, Fresh Air, and he's also a professor at UC Berkeley.
This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has chosen his word of the year. We'll let Jeff tell you what it is and why he picked it.
It's word of the year time again. Collins Dictionaries chose fake news, and Dictionary.com went with complicit. Others have proposed hashtag me too, alternative facts, take a knee, resistance, and snowflake. It's striking how many of those are the words and phrases that warring political camps have been hurling at each other across our deepening national divide. The Trump presidency didn't create that rift, but it sort of made it official. The acrimonious climate has ruined a lot of Thanksgivings. As two economists recently demonstrated, using cell phone tracking data, they found that Americans from politically divided families spent 20 minutes less time at the holiday dinner table after the election than the year before. Wonkish terms like hyperpolarization don't begin to convey that sense of unrelenting rancor. Instead, the meme of the moment is to say that American politics has become tribal, which I'll make my word of the year. It's not a new word even in that meaning, but in one form or another, it's become the ubiquitous diagnosis for most of our political ills. America's cursed with tribal morality. Tribalism is responsible for fake news and for our inability to confront sexual harassment. Meanwhile, people abroad raise the specter of the new tribalism, wherever the traditional nation-state seems to be fraying at the seams, from Catalonia to Scotland. The word tribe is a little problematic, even in its traditional sense, as the primordial social group that predates the nation-state, united by kinship, language, and rituals. Tribe has a legal status in the U.S., and there's nothing pejorative in using it for the Chippewa or Hopi. But indigenous peoples in other parts of the world object to the word's connotations of superstition, backwardness, and savagery. Organizations like UNESCO stopped using tribe some years ago in favor of terms like nation or ethnic group. But of course, it's precisely those savage ooga-booga stereotypes that make tribe so evocative when you attach it to the political groups of modern societies. It suggests that their members have regressed to a more primitive social level, where they're motivated only by their bond with their own kind and their hostility to outsiders. At the limit, the story goes, they're driven purely by primal emotions of fear and rage, which bubble up from the evolutionary depths of what people like to call the lizard brain. To a lot of people, political tribalism suggests those red and blue family members glowering at each other across the holiday dinner table, impatient to hurry back to their bubbles. They're people whose partisan identities become so central that it determines whom they're willing to date and what brands of pizza and coffee makers they buy, not to mention which news stories they're willing to believe. But for others, tribalism is just another name for identity politics, though which identities count as tribal depends on your point of view. The fact is that however people map out the geography of American political tribes, they always exempt themselves and their neighbors. In modern America, we don't think of our own political allegiances as tribal. We're the creatures of reason. That gives the word a kind of incantatory power. Calling a group tribal is just a way of pronouncing them impervious to rational discussion. Or as one political blogger put it, there's no reasoning with a reptile. People use tribal to obliterate the differences between solidarity and blind group loyalty, between principled concern and reflexive rage, between the cerebral cortex and the brainstem. But this isn't surprising. If we can't see eye to eye on who are the political tribes and who are the forces of civilization, it's because we're fragmented into factions that deny one another's legitimacy. That's what it means to say that America's become tribal in the first place. And one sign of that is that we can't agree on how to use the word.
What does that bring up for you? I saw you making some notes as you were listening to that.
Well, I just really appreciated that we're starting off with the idea that tribalism can mean different things. It can evoke emotions that may or may not be intended to be evoked, and that the word itself has some controversy in it.
Yeah. And it's kind of like using an analogy, right? Because you're yes. using the you're using the word tribal in a way that it now, with respect to the political differences in beliefs, you're using it not the way it was traditionally used by anthropologists or by groups identifying themselves. One of the things that this brings up for me is I tried to, because we're talking about tribalism and polarization increasing. Mm-hmm. We're making the assumption that it's increasing. Mm-hmm. Kevin
well,
de
certainly... LaPlante
assumed and was convinced that it was increasing. But one of the things we do when we're doing critical thinking is, first of all, if we see some phenomenon that we think may be true and have some implications underlying it, is to indeed check it out and see if that phenomenon mm-hmm. is real, right?
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes we'll find out that it's overblown, that maybe it's there, but in such rare form that it's not even worth considering.
Hmm.
It's not a trend or whatever. So I took it upon myself to do a little research. Go ahead.
Talking about it certainly has been a trend. I think that's one thing
that's
we've
true.
All observed.
Exactly. And that's one caveat that we're making in this show and in these two shows that we did, is that we're attempting to look at something that's in the zeitgeist right now, mm-hmm. tribalism and polarization, and to make some sense out of it, to put it in some sort of context.
Mm-hmm.
We're not necessarily advocating that it's on the rapid rise or that it's being in a tribe is a horrible thing with no advantages to it. And we're going to talk about that later on.
And we do need to make sense of the things we're hearing people talk about.
Exactly. And one of the things, though, I didn't come across anything where people had done a complete study or several studies of the rise in tribalism and polarization. But we did shows, our first show that we did on having civil dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
I quoted that annual poll that's called Civility in America,
mm-hmm.
and they found a bunch of things that showed that there was incivility, that incivility has been on the rise and has continued to rise. And for example, one thing they saw is that there's a record high rate of Americans, 75%, that agree incivility in America has risen in crisis levels. So that's a survey, a poll, people observing it, and that's a pretty high percentage, 75%. And that it's risen to crisis levels, with 84% of the respondents indicating that they have personally experienced incivility, mm-hmm. and 99% saying they quit. No, I'm sorry, 59%. 99 would be a real high percentage there, but 59. This is distressing in itself, even at 59%, saying that they quit paying attention to politics because of incivility.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm one of them.
So that's one of those things that we talk about, is as polarization increases, it gets people to just bow out of mm-hmm. political awareness, political activity, and being aware and informed about what's happening politically, that's very dangerous to mm-hmm. democracy.
Absolutely.
So now this incivility poll figures doesn't necessarily say that it's caused by polarization, but it's kind of intuitively friendly that there's a relationship there. The other thing that I want to say is that the word tribe, we've already sort of alluded to, which describes this modern trend of different camps having different core beliefs, is limited because it really doesn't match what anthropologists talk about as tribes. An anthropologist would say something like this in terms of defining a tribe. A social division is a traditional society consisting of families or communities linked by social, economic, religious, or blood ties with a common culture and dialect, typically having a recognized leader. There was an article in the Chicago online, chicagotribune.com, that is called A Liberal Defense of Tribalism, and it was written by anthropologist Lawrence Rosen, who actually made that critique and pointed out that the way tribalism is being used colloquially now, the zeitgeist word of tribalism, is pretty inconsistent in many ways with the way an anthropologist uses the word.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point to as we dive into this.
Okay, any other reactions to that first clip that we had?
Something that stuck out to me was solidarity versus blind group loyalty. Mm. And to me, that really accentuates that the content versus association. Solidarity is to say, I believe in this. I, you know, as an example, believe in labor unions, and therefore I am in solidarity with labor unions. That it is a group of which you're assigning to, but it has a sort of philosophy or purpose in which you are ascribing to. And then there's blind group loyalty, where you say, I am simply affiliated with, and therefore I agree with. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important differentiation. And sometimes, it is a way to say, oh, you're just being tribalistic about this, to dismiss someone that they aren't coming from a place of content, to make them illegitimate as far as their position. So I think as we go forward in this discussion, it's really important to kind of note that sometimes the grouping is by philosophy or content or ideology, and then sometimes it's by simply affiliation with the people that whether it's proximity or, you know, something like that. It's just to be near people.
But if you're affiliated with a particular, and you feel that, and you would call that affiliation a tribe, this is my tribe. Mm-hmm. I've heard people say that. This is my tribe. What I'm wondered about is how many people, if they affiliate strongly with a tribe, if the tribal ethos is something that they don't agree with, let's say one part of that, mm-hmm. Thing that is held as a kind of a standard in that tribe, mm-hmm. standard belief. If the person doesn't agree with that, do they speak out about it? Do they say something about it? Or does that endanger them as being a legitimate card-carrying member of the tribe?
Yeah.
See, that's where the downside comes, because then it turns into groupthink, right? Mm-hmm. If you're afraid to speak out about something that the majority of your tribe believes, and you either put it in question or at least bring it up as a topic of conversation, you know, do you hold back or are you willing to do that? That might be a question for our listeners during the call-in part of the show, which will start at about 7:45, and we'll give the phone numbers, let you know when that will happen. So give that a thought.
Yeah.
But that does come
back to the content, the idea,
yes,
versus the affiliation.
Yeah. So you're saying that you could be affiliated with a tribe and feel that solidarity, that kinship, without worrying too much about every belief that is in the realm of that tribe.
Yeah, if that tribe permits.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to the next clip that we have, because tribalism, along with its in-group and out-group dynamics that we started to talk about here, is wired to our biological hardware and programmed into our cultural software. That's as given by Amy Chua in her most recent book. Do you know what other book she wrote?
I don't.
Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom.
Ooh.
Yeah, she got in a lot of hot water with that book, being a tiger mom. Well, anyway, she writes in her newest book, Political Tribes, about this. The book is called Political Tribes, Group Instinct and the Fate of Nations. And I saw an interview with her on Book TV and recorded this clip from that. This is Amy Chua.
The starting point is that human beings are tribal. Really tribal, I mean, biologically so. So some of my favorite parts of the book are actually not quite about the politics part, but there are some fascinating studies. I'll just tell you about one. Recently, researchers took kids that were between ages of 4 and 8 and randomly assigned the team or the blue team and, you know, gave them T-shirts of the corresponding colors. They then sat these children in front of these computer docs and showed them computer-edited images of children, half wearing blue and half wearing red. The researchers then asked the children, the subjects, for their reactions to these kids. The results were astonishing. Even though these children knew nothing about the children in the pictures, they consistently and passionately said that they liked the children better who were wearing their color. They wanted to allocate more resources to them, and they thought they were better in every way, smarter, more moral, nicer people. Almost more troubling, these kids displayed a unconscious bias. When told stories about these kids, and then asked the children about them afterwards, the children systematically remembered all the good things about the people wearing on their team, and all the negative things about people on the other side. So, and there are tons more studies like this that show that we desperately want to belong to these groups, and once we connect to a group, it's almost like facts don't matter. We just want to see everything through the lens of that tribe, and if you are presented with evidence that your tribe is doing something wrong, something bad, your response is often just to stick to your tribe. And your feeling in doing that is not that you're being stupid or irresponsible, it's that you're being loyal. We can't be at this point where the people who voted on the other side are not just people we disagree with, but they're actually, we view them as immoral enemies, like as not Americans. If we start to view people on the other side of the political divide as not real Americans, then we really are going to fracture into two or more.
All right, and I just want to say that there was a little glitch in the sound, and that was on the original recording. And what it was it meant to say randomly assigned. These kids, this group of kids, were randomly assigned T-shirts and randomly assigned to one of two teams, a red team and a blue team. And then they, you know, got together, and so they sort of were a team, right? Here's the red shirts and here's the blue shirts. And then they showed them pictures of other children in red or blue, and they had them do appraisals of those children. We asked them different questions, how much would they be attracted to that other kid in the picture? So it kind of gives some evidence, and these kinds of studies, this is not the only study, there's a number of studies like this that show that there is some pre-wiring towards this. Mm-hmm. In other words, a biological evolutionary pre-wiring in our brain that gives us this kind of affiliation with groups that we feel that we identify with. And it starts pretty early.
Which intuitively makes perfect sense.
It does.
I mean, if someone looks like me, I'm going to try and help them out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because they're like me.
Exactly. And they don't have to physically, facially resemble you. They just have to have some, there has to be some characteristic. In this case, simple as the color of a T-shirt. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is something that that has been demonstrated in social science and psychology through a number of studies. And tribes are sort of have provided in our past evolutionary past a focal point for identification, and they've served as forums for developing and imprinting cultural practices. And when I think of it that way, it dawned on me that tribes are almost like little cultural laboratories. And there's a diversity of different practices from this tribe to this mm-hmm. tribe in terms of the kind of gods they worship, the kind of social mores or, you know, the etiquette or ethics that they have in their interactions, the way they treat other people from other tribes and that kind of thing. So each one then kind of imprints the members of the tribe on these belief systems. And if that tribe expands and is successful, that cultural practice then is working. Mm-hmm. So it's a cultural evolution that's accompanying. But the problem is that our biological evolution has lagged way behind our cultural and technological evolution. So our cultural evolution and technological evolution is very advanced of what our biological wiring is. And this makes me think of some of the stuff that we've talked about on previous shows, the intuitive, which is more our wiring, our biological heuristics, mental heuristics, mm-hmm. rules of thumb.
Instinctive
that we have versus, and that we've called the fast thinking versus our slow thinking, which is more the deliberate. That's more cultural because we've developed logic, we've developed statistics to go to and factor into our reasoning process, and a number of the scientific process. You know, mm-hmm. So all of this comes from our culture, and we have technologies now that are so advanced. So that is what came to my mind, is the lag between our mm. biological evolution arc and our cultural technological evolution.
Just can't move as fast is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. It takes a lot longer to make those biological changes through the evolutionary process than it does the cultural. And that's the equivalent of genes, which are the biological, are called memes. Mm-hmm. That's Richard Dawkins' term mm-hmm. for how our culture advances, and those advance very quickly. We know that memes, especially in this social media that we have now, mm-hmm. how fast memes
yes definitely
carry through. Okay, what came up for you in that clip?
Well, I just was listening to you and I went on so many different avenues. Just to stick with memes, I was trying to think what would be some interesting, silly examples besides politics. We could talk politics all day. What would be some silly, interesting examples of, say, tribalism or polarization in everyday life? And I couldn't help but think about the meme pineapple on pizza. Now, if you spend a lot of time on the internet like I do, you'll find that people feel very passionately about this topic, more passionately than I ever knew people felt about pizza in general. And there are what you would say polarized warring tribes of the pineapple on pizza tribe and the no pineapple on pizza tribe. And if you're a friend who identifies as one, and then you don't see it the same way as them, it becomes moral tribalism. You're wrong, you're disgusting, you're gross, and I'm never having dinner with you again, period. I'm telling you, just look at the pineapple on pizza meme.
I've missed that one.
It's just been in the last few months, as memes do come and go very quickly. But we can also cite the blue versus black dress.
Mm-hmm.
If you heard about that one, some people saw a blue dress, some people saw a black dress.
Oh, yes. The Clinton era. No, go ahead.
And some people, it's just, how could you see a black dress? I absolutely cannot fathom how you, a perfectly smart, intelligent person, would not see what I see.
Yes. And I kind of miss the pineapple pizza thing. Do you think that's more kind of in fun than it is real?
It's hard to say on the internet.
Yeah.
Yes. There's definitely an element of fun, and there's definitely times that it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it kind of mirrors what we do in politics and what we do in these other areas too.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Except it's not quite as drastic or overshadowing in terms of our lives. But again, like you say, there's probably people that are really serious about it.
I'm willing to put money that friends have been unfriended on Facebook over pineapple and pizza.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, I was just looking for a silly example, so we're not all just doom and gloom here,
fine.
We tribalize, we polarize, we find divisions in the strangest, oddest little things.
And if you do use Facebook after we do this show, I invite you to come to our Facebook page, Thinking Clearly Radio, on Facebook. And I have a graphic that you just said that people can see something different. Each one will swear that they saw it that way. I have a wonderful graphic that I'm going to put up when I put up the link to our podcast.
Okay, check that out tomorrow. You know, the other thing, I want to talk about polarize. I'm going to go off on a slight little tangent here, but I was thinking about to polarize, and I can't help but kind of think about physics a little bit, that you have things of polarity, and that means they're direct opposites. And that also means as one position moves, that direct opposite is also going to move to stay in exact opposition. Does that make sense? Like magnets. And that is also sometimes, I think, that happens, coming back to content versus the loyalty. I think we do see in politics polarization where the position of one tribe moves and therefore the position of the other tribe moves because they are simply so caught up in being warring tribes. Yeah.
So that's a reactive kind of, they're not reacting to changing content, they're reacting to the changing position of the other tribe.
Absolutely.
So you have to pay a lot of attention to the other tribe.
And it's no longer content driven.
Yeah, yeah, that's a cool thought. It kind of makes me think of, have you ever been at a party with someone that you just didn't like?
That's all the parties.
What I have noticed is always boggles my mind if I'm at a party with someone that I'm not comfortable with or I have an issue with or whatever, I always know where that person is.
That's it.
It's like radar. It's like, okay, I know where that person is. They're over there now.
You're one polarity and they're the other.
So it's that same kind of idea, you know, is that you are reactive. You know, what you do is reactive to that other group. Mm-hmm. So you wind up paying a lot of attention to what they're all about. Okay, well, there's lots of other things that, and hopefully this is bringing up issues with the callers. Remember, around 7:45, we're going to open phone lines and we'll give the phone number at that particular time. But at this juncture, we're going to go for a third clip here. This is talking about tribalism itself not being a negative state of affairs, and this is kind of what Julia just alluded to. It's when the tribes become polarized that things go south. So we're going to listen to Georgia State University political science professor Jennifer McCoy's thoughts on polarization. This is from an NPR interview done by Kelly McEvers in April of last year.
As the Senate considers radically changing its rules to require only a majority to get a Supreme Court justice approved, one professor says a move like that would only polarize U.S. politics more. Georgia State University professor Jennifer McCoy researches polarized democracies like Venezuela, Turkey, and Hungary. And this week in The Washington Post, she argues there are lessons the U.S. should learn from those countries. She's with us now from member station WABE in Atlanta. Professor McCoy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
So to start with, what does it mean for a democracy to be polarized? I mean, what do you see in these governments in Turkey, Venezuela, and Hungary?
Well, what we are seeing is When voters divide into opposing camps, they come to view the other side not any longer as a political adversary, as in a healthy democracy, just one to compete against and occasionally to negotiate and compromise with, but instead as a threatening enemy to be vanquished. And that means that compromise is no longer possible, negotiations and communications break down, and people begin to perceive and be afraid of the other side.
How polarized is the American system as compared to these other places that you research?
What we do see in the United States is over the last 15 to 20 years, one is the growing distance between peoples and between the political parties as they each become more homogeneous within themselves, the Democrats and Republicans, and further apart. But the second part of it that's very important is the growing antipathy. So that is this perception that the other side is actually threatening, that if they come to power, if they win the elections, that that is threatening to our way of life.
So what, from what you've seen in these three countries, what's the result of polarization? What happens?
Well, there's three possible outcomes. One is simply paralyzing gridlock, where the two camps can't negotiate and compromise and arrive at any decisions at all. A second is that you may see a veering back and forth between two sides, so that one side is in power for a while and is imposing its decisions on the other side, and that creates a backlash, and they'll be removed. And then the other side gets in, and they do the same thing. The third is that the leader can stay in power, can change rules such as election rules that will benefit them, and begin to isolate, divide, and repress their opponents. And you can see a growing authoritarian trend in those cases.
So how can democracies reverse this process? How can you depolarize a political system?
One way to do it is to change the things that allow one side to gain too much power or to make, you know, political fights like elections a winner-take-all game. So in the United States, that would have to do with redistricting and not allowing the political parties to control the redistricting decisions to benefit themselves and to benefit the incumbents. But there's also a strong effect at the individual level where when people are afraid that if somebody's own self-concept or worldview is threatened, they refuse to receive new information that may disconfirm that. Even if we can get out of our echo chambers and only, you know, and we can hear more points of view, people will still tend to reject the view that does not fit with their pre-existing beliefs. So we've got to find ways to bring people together and tap into their shared humanity. That is to give them experiences where they can begin to empathize again with the other person.
That's Jennifer McCoy. She's a political science professor at Georgia State University in Atlanta. She talked to us from member station WABE. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Any thoughts on that, Julia?
Oh, boy, that was on point.
Yeah.
It is. I could I share an article I
sure.
found? This is about politics.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually about retired Senator Lieberman, who was known for not affiliating with one tribe very well. I'm not sure how to say that exactly. He did not fit into a box.
Mm-hmm.
He's been cited a few times describing our bipartisanship as warring tribes, and I thought that was interesting. This is a quote from an article very recently from CBN, where Lieberman says, "In many ways, the American people are better at this than the politicians are," he added, "at not being polarized. They work with people, they, American citizens, work with people who are different from they are in many ways, and yet they develop good friendships with them, and they are satisfying, and they grow from them. We get divided by political labels or ideological labels in politics. It's nonsense. It does not only stop, it not only stops us from getting things done for people who were good enough to send us here, our constituents, it also deprives of the satisfaction, happiness, and education that I've derived from some of the friendships with Republicans." And then I wanted to go on to say, let's see, I'm going to skip forward a little bit. I'm afraid these parties are increasingly becoming sort of homogenous in terms of opinions, and we're getting to be like warring tribes, Lieberman said. They seem to be more interested in killing the other tribe than in helping the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big part of why President Trump got elected, because he was from the outside and he promised something different. I mean, I just found that so insightful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's insightful, and it's so much of what's happening in our Congress.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like he very well articulated the short-sightedness of being polarized.
Definitely.
And then I just wanted to exit with they pitch his newest book, and they talk about how, of course, he's praying for his buddy John McCain. And Lieberman also believes there's a prescription for today's division within our rich faith traditions. He says, this is a quote, "You know, the other thing that ought to bring people together across party lines is a certain amount of humility," he explained. "We're created in God's image, but none of us is divine. None of us has divine powers. We all have reason to be humble, and that ought to make us want to work together to get something done."
Mm-hmm. So he has his philosophy, and that is one of the issues that I did want to talk about tonight is, you know, is this polarization, should we be concerned about it in our democracy, and should we get into talking about some strategies to depolarize the situation? And that, I think that's a big issue. So, you know, I'd like to elaborate on that a little bit. And I'm going to give a quote from Kevin de la Plante, who was our guest last month. He says, quote, "My view is that it's misguided to think of tribal psychology per se as the problem. The problem facing us today is how our tribal psychology operates when polarization becomes extreme."
Mm-hmm.
And to continue that thinking is that polarization begins to become toxic. This is not his quote, but when it begins to become toxic, when the tribes can no longer communicate or want to communicate with each other and begin to think of each other as unable to reason or even act morally. And the extreme of that is they're not even human,
mm-hmm.
you know, to dehumanize the other.
Or they're not
folks.
Patriots, or they're not us, or
yes.
they're not from around here.
Yes.
All those things.
And I want to say that when we as a tribe begin to polarize against another tribe, it tends to build solidarity within our tribe.
Absolutely.
That's a function that it has, mm-hmm. but it also tends to polarize us even further from those other groups. Well, you know, one aspect that I've thought about is in this polarization issue is the amount of overlap in basic values. But there can also be good overlap in values, but a separation in means to achieve those outcomes. In other words, you can have people in different tribes that have underneath, they have the basic values are very similar, but they have a different view of how to manifest those mm-hmm. values. And what comes to mind there is the schism between the traditional Greens, environmentalists, the back to the earth, save the earth, go back to natural things, with what's called another tribe, the eco-pragmatists. And the eco-pragmatists believe that we can use technology to solve our problems and to live sustainably and to create a more healthy planet, to preserve species and that kind of thing. They're environmentalists. They'd all agree on those environmental values. But they believe things like, for example, that nuclear power, the temporary use of nuclear power to mitigate the reliance on fossil fuels is a trade-off that is good in the long run as we transition to alternative energy, or maybe sometime we'll actually harness fusion and then we'll be home free in terms of the energy.
Or stop using so much energy.
But there's an agreement. The traditional Greens would say, stop using it, be conservative. Let's go back to more natural processes, less energy intensive processes. Progress is and growth is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the eco-pragmatists will say, growth and progress is a good thing. We can harness these technologies and use them wisely. So it's a split.
And I'm sure some people say, and you're not a real environmentalist.
Exactly. They do. They get very annoyed at each other, just like the pineapple pizza folks.
We can see this within all the parties right now. The Democrats are going through quite a bit of turmoil as to what it means to be a Democrat. The Republicans are going the same way. They can barely figure it out. They have their own tribal, their warring tribes inside.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. And I want to bring up one other issue, and then we'll give the phone numbers and give the listeners a chance to weigh in on this topic. But the whole idea of should we work on depolarizing our democracy under the assumption that it's not healthy for our democracy? And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about, I think it depends on your philosophy, your theory of change. There are people who are incrementalists, who, like our system's not perfect, we have a lot of things that we can go towards that will benefit people and live out our values better. But one idea for change is to stay within our system and find ways to influence the system. It goes back to like the Bernie folks. If they would have kept endorsing Bernie all the way through, even though he lost the election, and Hillary would have been elected, then they could have been a base there to influence more progressive values. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a revolutionary, though, if you believe in revolutionary change, it seems to me that you want polarization, because the more polarization that you have, the more fertile ground you have for a real revolution. How can you have a revolution if you don't have polarization? So this is an issue.
I think your bias is showing, Bob.
Why is that?
Because we've talked about revolutions in the past, you and I, and I think you have a certain conception of who revolutionaries are and what they want, as in people who throw away the system and recreate it. And so coming back to that your sort of intuitive hypothesis here is that revolutionaries would want more polarization. Did you just say that?
Yes.
I would argue.
Oh, good.
That revolutionaries are often, historically, at least in America, we just came out of the 4th of July, that that they're too content-oriented to want extreme polarizations. Revolutionaries often have a very strong philosophy behind why they want the revolution, and it doesn't require a polarity necessarily.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting idea, and I think that's something that we could elaborate on. Maybe this will be another demonstration of civil dialogue between you and I. But it does go back to a comment. I published an article in the North Coast, latest edition of the North Coast Journal, on tribalism and polarization. And I want to read a comment that was made to that article, because it kind of hits on this idea that I just brought up. It goes like this, quote, and it starts out, I'm going to give you the starting point and the ending point, but not the middle point of the comment. But the starting point starts out with saying, "Conscientious polarization has been a prerequisite of every successful, significant, enduring social justice advancement in human history. Well represented in the U.S., union suffrage, civil rights, slavery, etc." And the comment ends with, "Get angry and organize with your tribe." So that hits on the idea of revolution, activism, and that kind of thing that I would argue thrives on polarization. Mm-hmm. Well, let's give listeners a chance to weigh in. I have one more clip, but we're not going to be able to get into that. But you can go to, you can just Google "In Our Tribe We Trust," and you can get to Kevin De La Plante's YouTube video, which is called "In Our Tribe We Trust." It's a 33-minute great video, and I just had taken a clip from it, but you can listen to the whole video by doing it with YouTube. So, or get into this issue of the dangers. Is tribalism and polarization dangerous to our democracy, or any other thoughts that you have?
I want to come back to polarity. I'm really stuck on this.
You
I love
are.
It. I am. We've talked about being human. Sometimes we are, let's say, confronted with information that's different than how we thought the world worked, right? Mm-hmm. And what's our first instinct when that happens? we have a cognitive dissonance. We question what we've known. Our impulse is not to believe it, because then we have to start changing our mind about things and the implications that might have on the other things we believe to be true. It can be kind of distressing. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes when we have a tribal polarization, there's that instinct to protect the identity of the tribe. And I think that was brought up, identity protective. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little bit of the knee-jerk reaction that happens as well, is that, well, who are we anymore? Mm-hmm. You know, if you know, they took that position, we have to take a different position.
Even though we might not completely endorse that position, we advocate for it because it belongs to our tribe and we belong to the tribe.
Yes.
All right. And Julia, you want to extend that thinking a little bit, or did you get that thought out completely?
Yeah, that was pretty much what I was thinking about, is that we have our identity tied up in our tribes, you know, being a part of our tribe. And I think that is important when we talk about the sort of reactions.
Yeah. And it makes me think that you could, for example, we had the Redwood Summer here, right? And we had the folks that wanted to save the Redwoods pitted against the loggers. Mm-hmm. Those are two different tribes. But I heard about, I wasn't here at that particular time, I wasn't involved with that directly, but I've heard stories about how the two got into some civil dialogues, mm-hmm. respectful, empathic kind of communication with each other, and that they felt some change had actually occurred. So we do have another caller. Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So, you've been talking about tribalism and the polarization in that. And I think that today's polarization is, like, I would say, 90, if not more percent, artificial. Mm-hmm. It's artificial polarization. And it's put in there by what I call the ruling classes, whose name I don't know and don't want to know. But it is polarization that is setting people apart right now in a completely irrational way. What you were just saying, we don't even know who we are anymore. But let me give you a little example. I know some folks who have voted pretty conservatively, but they're also members of local fire departments, rescue teams, and when they're called upon to go and help somebody or rescue somebody, they don't ask for these people's affiliation, the color of their skin, their sexual orientation, or anything like that. So I think it's really good to stop actually becoming polarized by these little details that we seem to have about each other. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
You know, you're talking about the overlap of values.
It's artificial now. This guy that is sitting at the head of our government right now, he's a puppet. He is completely a symptom of the puppetry that is laid upon us.
And he's playing to tribal polarization, right?
But sir, let me tell you something. This word tribal, for one, the tribes that lived before we became nations, they never called themselves tribes. That's an academic concept, you know, tribes.
Yeah, and we don't want to conflate the two.
Excuse me?
We don't want to conflate the two. They're different things.
Exactly. You don't want to confuse the two. A nation is not a tribe, and a tribe is not necessarily a nation. A tribe is a bunch of people that live together biologically. They don't even have politics.
Yeah,
very primitive, their politics. Our politics have become so complicated that we can be divided by artificial polarization. That's what's going on.
Part of what you say, I've thought about too, and that's that whereas our, evolutionarily speaking, where our historical tribes allowed us to be cooperative with one another, and it allowed us to develop specialization of roles, it had a lot of evolutionary value to help us get to where we are. But as we then started domesticating animals, agriculture came along, nations, urbanization came along, nation states came along, and now we're left living in this very complex world that has global problems. And so tribalism and separation and polarization, something that got us to this, to the place of, I hate to use the word dominance on the planet, but we are able to control our environment, and we're very successful species in that regard. What got us?
You think so? We're successful?
In that regard, we're successful.
Because we think we are successful. We're screwing this place up at a really fast pace. And you're calling that successful?
I want to give you an idea of a book to read that will maybe be a counterpoint to what you said. You know who Steven Pinker is?
No.
Okay, he's a cognitive psychologist, and he wrote the book Better Angels of Our Nature: Why Violence Has Declined. That's one book, and he has a latest book, which is a follow-up to that, which is called Enlightenment Now: The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. And he makes kind of a counter case to what you're saying, that we've screwed up the planet, that things are going to hell in a handbag, and that we are a species that is destined and doomed to be gobbled up by our own technology and will to progress. And it's worth reading, and it is a whole other topic.
I'll read the book, okay, sir, but have you ever looked up at the sky lately? I don't need to read books about what we're being done to in the skies. I don't need to read books to see what's going on with the weather, how interesting it's becoming, how there are like droughts right now in Holland, right? A country that is 95% under sea level, they're having problems with droughts.
It seems to me like there's two tribes right here.
They'll drown there.
Okay,
the planet is changing fast, sir.
Gotcha. Listen, we're right up against the clock. The next programmer is in there, anxious to get his show started.
We appreciate our callers.
And
thank you for calling.
It's a whole big topic that we can maybe get into in some later show. Yeah. Not tonight. Your time is up. Sorry that we left you so little time. We just talk, don't we, Julia?
We do. But I do. I love that. That was, we came here with agreement,
yes,
and then we kind of found some,
into tribal
some division.
Exactly.
I love it.
That's great.
And so on that thought,
going to invite you back to Thinking Clearly.
Think for yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.